Aw, yeah. That sound marks the start of the 52nd Missal for the Masses. I am your host, Gary, and this is the Chaplain's Assistant's Motor Pod. This is my podcast where I talk about my life in collecting G.I. Joe and other military and adventure toy lines, and where most every episode I talk about a vehicle, playset, or trailer from the G.I. Joe of Real American Hero toy line from 1982 to the present day. Before I get into what's going on in my life of collecting, I would like to mention I still have a bunch of Chaplain's Assistant's Motor Pod t-shirts left. I have men's sizes small through 3 extra large. I'm currently out of extra large, probably the most popular size. So if you'd like one or more, they're $12 each shipped. If you're looking for extra large, tell your friends who don't wear that size so I can have my friends at robertbaronsinc.com make some more for me. Just email chaplainjoepod@gmail.com so I can make arrangements to get them out. As I'm recording, the biggest news is in G.I. Joe comics. Now, while issue 3 of Void Rivals is out now, and I haven't even talked about issue 2 yet, is that the solicit of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero 301 was made public via Bleeding Cool's website. It's a 6-page preview featuring art by Chris Mooneyham. Thanks to @1BrianEllen on X, formerly Twitter, for the heads up. The link will be in the description of this podcast. From the preview, we can easily see Hama picking up all the loose threads from issue 300. And Mooneyham's art, while a departure from S.L. Gallant's, still fits the G.I. Joe universe in a gritty style that evokes memories of Lanil Francis Yu's time on Transformers G.I. Joe crossover that was published by Dreamwave Comics. The inks aren't as heavy, and the colors are much brighter, so it's still a gritty feel, but there's life to the pages, and his facial expressions look good. Some really good storytelling in these opening pages of issue 301. Without spoiling anything, the first few pages set up nicely for someone that didn't catch the IDW run. There's even a glib comment by Dr. Mindbender that might be pointed in some criticism by, quote, reviewers, unquote. I'm kind of sad about the 6-page because to me it spoils some of the tension for picking up issue 301. Either way, it looks like a solid setup for the new audience that will be shown G.I. Joe now that it is in Skybound's library. The Andy Kubert cover art, again, looks amazing. And the best part is it says 301st issue with a little like logo in the lower corner of the cover. That, to me, reminds me of Kirkman's Invincible when he would pick up at issue 51 or some other spots where it would be a good jumping on point for the series, and it seems that Kirkman's editorial or stewardship is mimicking that. So for me, that is a good indication of what's going on, because the G.I. Joe Real American Hero series has had not the best sales in the past, so that maybe this will be for followers of Skybound, this will be a title that they'll pick up as well. My opinion is that good sales for any or all of the Joe titles only helps the Joe titles continue to get published, number one, but also brings brand awareness as well. I'll get back to Void Rivals next missile. It pertains to the Energon universe, so the least I can do is give it a quick review. So far, not so much G.I. Joe content, but it's still that Energon universe where G.I. Joe and Transformers are intertwined. Now, in my world of collecting, it's been a few weeks since I went to Terrificon at Mohegan Sun in Connecticut, hanging out with my friends John and Lloyd from The Pint, Eve, and Sal and Russo from Robert Barons, Inc. My goal at this Comic-Con was basically to look for comics to finish my Daredevil and Atari Force runs. And thanks to a bonus from work, the one piece I wanted to treat myself to was Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, number one. This is particularly a comic book convention, not a toy convention. But now that G.I. Joe is in the zeitgeist of pop culture more and more each day, I'm walking around and I'm easily distracted by the G.I. Joe figures that are out on display for purchase. As usual, there's plenty of classified. I was looking for the Walmart exclusives I've had on pre-order well over a year now, and they were there, with only a few that were reasonably marked up. The first booth that I came across with O-Ring Joes had prices that were haphazard or out of line. They were all over the place. There was a Cobra Law Guard, incomplete, with a broken antenna peg on his head. That was $40. Meanwhile, a few things back on the peg in the container was a Zartan missing his thigh pads and chest plate. That was only $17. And it looked like the O-ring was intact too. Hindsight being 2020, I probably should have picked up the Zartan, but I passed on it as I don't need another. I found three Daredevils for half off if you paid in cash, and that brings me down to six books left to completing my Daredevil collection. Walking around some more, I found a guy. He was selling a carded Zartan Ninja Force, the bubbles lifting, which I enjoy, and it was only $25, so I picked it up. I looked further into his booth, and I saw he had a Steel Brigade in an oversized clamshell. But there were more oversized clamshells. There were about six test shots or first shots of 1990s G.I. Joes. I passed on two Street Fighters, Kens, and a Chun-Li. He also had a 1993 Major Altitude test shot. That's the mail-away one. And I passed on that too because I didn't realize what it was when I was looking at it. And that's a hard to come by figure. So the test shot's only that much harder to come by. But what I did get was Big Ben and Big Bear from 1993's International Action Force set. This was definitely impulse purchase as I'm not a prototype guy, but turns out the vendor knew the guy that published Action Figure and Toy Review in the 1990s. That person bought a lot of Hasbro overstock, including all the 93 International Action Force sets. The vendor was really nice, let me take some pictures, probably because I spent a good chunk of change with him. It was really nice, you know, just to get to see what else he had. But, you know, he didn't have a lot of Joe stuff, but what he had was quality. I went up to Artist Alley and saw Tim Jones from Sour Grapes. Really nice guy, does a really cool comic strip, you know, newspapers. And then I finished off with a nice chat with Paul Kupperberg, the man that redefined Peacemaker in the mid-80s. At that point, the day was over, and I finally pulled the trigger on a not unreasonably priced CGC-graded Hero for Hire number one. That final purchase put me a bit over budget, but in reality, that's the fault of the first shots that I picked up. Two days later, I was on the plane to Orlando, Florida to visit Disney World once again. My wife's vice is Disney, and she puts up with my vices, so it's part of, you know, my life of collecting, I guess. I always like taking action figures with me just to have something for me to distract from the Disney-ness or the, you know, because I'm not really into Disney as much as she is. And she humors me by understanding why I'm doing it. I was having a hard time figuring out which ones to pack. And I was trying to figure out a storyline in my head for what's going to happen at Disney this year with G.I. Joe or Cobra. And I reached out to my friend Steven from G.I. Joeberg, and I said, you know, I just need an idea. I got to figure out somebody to bring by and, you know, take some pictures with, you know, the sights and the sounds. And he recommended Recondo. And I was like, say no more. That gives me some ideas. And then I added Chuckles, Copperhead, and the HasLab Mickey Mouse Cobra Commander. Over the following days of the vacation, I posted on my Twitter account, X, Threads, Instagram, and Facebook each day. Basically, the storyline that I crafted was Cobra Commander went to Disney in festive attire, and the Joes are sent to intersect and bring him in. I had to take the picture opportunities when I could get them, and I concentrated on just having fun with my family. I usually don't bring accessories with me, but I tried something new, and I didn't really get out the accessories till the final night. And the only almost casualty was on that final night was almost losing Cobra Commander's laser pistol in mulch chips outside the boardwalk. You know, it was kind of fun. It wasn't taking anything too seriously. It was a nice way to just like, okay, here's a cool shot of what's going on at Disney. But, you know, here's these toys that just need to be there because at the end of the day, aren't we all just big kids at heart? Finally, the last thing before I get to my toy review is I did a live stream on Facebook and Twitter on opening up my 1994 G.I. Joe razor blade. I'll throw the Facebook or Twitter link below. I bought it with some eBay money from selling overstock out of my basement, so it's like it didn't cost me anything. I talked and I put it together on camera, and the few people that checked it out seemed to like it, so that is encouraging. Next time, I'm hoping to also add my YouTube account because StreamYard needed access that takes YouTube 24 hours to grant. With school starting soon, my schedule will be much more regular, and I'm going to try and work something in. But no guarantees, though. It's not usually where I try to do something in the beginning of the episode, but if you heard the, aw yeah, then you might have picked up that on this Missile for the Masses, we're talking about the Awe Striker from 1985. Now, before we get into the vehicle itself, the Awe Striker did come with a driver. It came with crankcase. And crankcase is a typical figure from 1985, which means he has the ball swivel neck and, you know, swivel arm battle grip. And he's really a nice traditional style soldier with brown boots, khaki pants. He's got a black pistol holster on his right thigh. He's got a green shirt with brown web belt and brown suspenders. He's got red epaulets. And his green shirt is actually over another khaki shirt. He's got a patch on his right shoulder and, you know, with the sleeves that are green and rolled up. He's wearing black gloves, like driving gloves, and he has a dark gray wristwatch on his left wrist. He's got dark brown eyes and eyebrows, while his mustache and hair is kind of a dark orange or burnt orange. And the pants are kind of chunky. They're a little baggy. They've got pockets on the front, which it would be handy, much like a pilot has, you know, the map on the top of his legs. As a driver, he has the pockets on the top of his legs as well. It's a solid traditional style action figure. It really goes well with the Awe Striker. He comes with a gray helmet. He comes with a black machine gun or automatic rifle. Even as a figure, while he doesn't come with a backpack, it's still like he's got two accessories. So he's kind of like I want to call him a deluxe figure, but he's like a fully fledged figure in and of himself, which just adds to the value of the Awe Striker. And the Awe Striker is a 3 flag point vehicle. So if an action figure is 1 flag point, for 3 flag points, you're getting a figure and a vehicle. So I'm thinking this was a deal in and of itself. Taking a look at Crankcase's file card, he is the Awe Striker driver, codename Crankcase. He's a grade E4. His file name is Elwood G. Indiana. He's from Lawrence, Kansas. His primary military specialty is motor vehicle driver, and his secondary military specialty is armor. Here is a guy that, while he's at home in the Ausstreicher, this is a guy that would play well, and especially in 1985, you're Mauler and, you know, Mobat, or, you know, basically armor, tanks. Armadillo, because we love the armadillo here at the Chaplain's Assistance Motor Pod. This is a very versatile character in just that little bit. And it goes on to describe, there are several ways to get from one place to another in Kansas, and driving fast is most of them. Crankcase was racing street machines when he was 16. This was no great feat, since he had been building them from the time he was 13. He worked the stock car circuit for years until the boredom hit him like a brick wall. A recruiting sergeant with a crooked smile signed him up for a burst of four with promises of speed and glory. Crankcase graduated Ranger School and Desert Warfare School and attended the Special Air Service Tactical Driving School under the NATO Exchange Program. He's a qualified expert, M16, M1911A1, M60, and TOW. The quote, ever get irritable when you're standing in the line that just doesn't seem to be moving at all? Well, the whole seems to be moving in slow motion to Crankcase all the time. That's why he's constantly ticked off. He's just not happy unless he has a wheel in one hand, a shifter in the other, and the wind in his face. So I think there's one word missing from that quote. It should say, well, the whole world seems to be moving in slow motion to Crankcase. That reminds me of Quicksilver in Marvel Comics. That's one of his character traits because he's such a fast guy. He thinks fast. This is in the litany of drivers or vehicle, you know, clutch and skid mark. Crankcase is another one of those guys that just likes to go fast. And, you know, it really seems like all these drivers would really get along well and probably cause a lot of problems in their off time. I like Crankcase. The other thing about with him being from Kansas and they're talking about the stock car circuit, I'm from the Northeast and we do have some short tracks up here. Not too much for NASCAR racing. That's more of the Southeast section of the United States. But Kansas, you know, that's to me, by that description, I'm thinking he's a short track guy. And if you've ever seen the World of Outlaws, those cars are actually kind of similar to the Ausstreicher. Not quite the same. And we'll get to the Ausstreicher now. Before we start reviewing the Ausstreicher is actually based on a real vehicle from the 1980s. It is based on the M1040 and M1041 fast attack vehicles that were introduced in 1982. Now, the difference between the M1040 and the M1041 is the M1040 had a Modus 50 cal machine gun mounted on top, and the M1041 had a TOW missile mounted on the top. I went online, I looked all these up. They had twin antenna, very similar, with the exception of fenders over the front tires. The Ausstreicher is almost a spitting image of these vehicles. It was known as the Emerson Chenauth, and I'm probably mispronouncing Chenauth, fast attack vehicle. It was powered by a 1,984cc four-cylinder air-cooled Volkswagen engine. It made a modest 94 horsepower at 5,000 RPM. But to be fair, this is only when unloaded, it's only about a 1,000-pound vehicle. So the power to weight isn't nearly as bad as, let's say, a 94 horsepower full-size car. The fast attack vehicle, the M1040, M1041, was part of the light attack battalion, using heavily armed light vehicles for fast moving attacks, recon, and target designation. The Sanriel dune buggy idea was a prominent idea, part of this project, and Emerson Electronics contracted Shenouth Racing Products to build 120 heavy-duty versions of Shenouth's desert racing vehicles. About 126 were built. The extra were for, let's call it, destructive testing, basically blowing them up with various weapon systems. It's kind of small. It has a 103-inch wheelbase. It's tubular framed. And the 542-to-1 final drive ratio gives it the little pickup that the 94-horsepower engine, you know, needed. So that's torque multiplication, allowing, you know, the thing to get off the line fast. However, with that high of a gear ratio, it's not going to be setting any land speed records. The top speed on the fast attack vehicle was 75 miles per hour, but the Army put a 55 mile per hour limit on it. Its size and profile put it in a category basically hard to hit. That was kind of advantageous because, much like the toy, the soldiers, you know, using the fast attack vehicle are very exposed. So the fast attack vehicle program eventually ended, where basically the 120 that were built were, you know, lost to attrition and to, you know, accidents and stuff like that. So 80 survived to get an upgrade, which included fenders and electronics and other amenities that brought it up to 1,500 pounds in a curb weight. But the program was dead. They weren't going to make any more. So what ended up happening with the remaining 80 at this point, they went to be used with special forces and, like, you know, Rangers, the SEALs, and even saw service during Desert Storm. From the research of the fast attack vehicle, the Awestriker is actually a rather faithful recreation of an existing military vehicle that really wasn't, as I like to call, toyified or G.I. Joe-ified with extra missiles and extra machine guns, and is rather faithful to the actual vehicle in the United States military. So now, turning my attention to the box of the Awestriker, looking at the front of the box, you have the Awestriker front and center firing off the cannon on the top. It crankcase is driving. Gung Ho is riding shotgun with his 40-millimeter grenade launcher, and Dusty's hanging on to the roll bar with one foot in the sidewall. It has a little window for crankcase to be visible through it, and it's just one of those Hector Garrido paintings that is just so epic and so ingrained in the first 4 years of the G.I. Joe line. One thing to mention before I go to the back of the box is it does call it the Awestriker with four-wheel suspension, and there'll be more on that in a little bit. So AWE and Awestriker is an acronym for All Weather and Environment, and we figured that out by looking at the back of the box. From the back of the box, the marketing, through blinding storms, G.I. Joe's all-weather and environment vehicle heads out on a scouting mission in search of Cobra strongholds. It's part of the new modern Army G.I. Joe collection of vehicles, weapons, figures, and accessories. Use it to help G.I. Joe defend democracy and battle his evil enemies. And just pointing out some things on the back of the box, sturdy construction for rugged play, carries up to four G.I. Joe figures, four-wheel suspension, super realistic detail, simulated remote control TV scanner, and front wheel steer, and top mounted cannon swivels and elevates. It's a good picture. It even shows a detailed removable engine with removable engine cover, because you can't get at the engine without it, and, you know, three flag points. So I think for 1985, this was a heck of a vehicle and heck of a value. Figure, vehicle. And we've already discussed it's based on a real one, so it has a lot of play potential there. Nope, not many gimmicks, but, you know, bear with me. We'll go over that as we now take a deeper dive into the vehicle itself using the blueprints as a guide. So before we take a look at the blueprints, the Awestriker is basically made up of a bunch of pieces. It's actually pretty model kitty, like a lot of the early G.I. Joe vehicles. It doesn't have a finished underside, but that's kind of forgivable considering what it's really mimicking. It's molded in green and gray. The wheels and interior and chassis are different shades of gray, which to me indicates they came off of different sprues and different kinds of plastic. Even the antenna are a lighter gray. And you have a hose that goes from the TV camera to the Canon on top. You have clear headlamp lenses that go over the front roll bar. You know, it's a simple design. You know, the roll cage, everything snaps together really nice and easy. I put together a Night Force version of this from 2001, 2002 with Pathfinder as the driver. And you have the gray engine and the green engine cover. So everything blends together. Everything looks super realistic. It is well thought out, well molded construction of a G.I. Joe vehicle. With that, taking a look at the Awestriker blueprints, 21 points to look at, you have number one, the extended space frame roll bar. That's what's molded in green. You even have decals that go on top of it that says watch head. In my opinion, those decals usually don't last long. I've tried applying vintage ones to the roll bar. I think I've even had a Toy Hacks Repro one. And the roll bar is very thin. It's maybe it's less than an eighth of an inch in diameter. And it's really hard sometimes to get these decals to wrap around it and stick. Almost like you need an aggressive glue on that. And the other thing about this space frame roll bar is the figures fit underneath it. We go to number two. We're on the back of the Awestriker, the fuel filter receptacle. So that is on the engine cover, the green engine cover that comes off. You go to number three, the two-way communications antennas. These gray antennas are commonly stressed, not straight. They have stress marks. They are just commonly missing. They come out easy, which actually comes in handy if you ever want to buy one of these or sell one of these. They come out easy, so you can ship it easy. Even if you're moving from place to place, you know, packs easily. You don't have to worry about breaking anything. That's always refreshing. There's two of them, so one for each side. So we're going to move to the top view of the Awestriker. And you have number four, the engine radiator oil cooler with electric cooling fans. Now, if you're paying attention earlier and you listen to the fact that the Fast Attack vehicle has a Volkswagen engine, you'll know that the Volkswagen engine is an air-cooled engine. So, but this is G.I. Joe, and yes, this is a faithful recreation, but it's still G.I. Joe. So you have a radiator, and you do have an oil cooler with electric cooling fans. So all that means is that G.I. Joe took out that 94 horsepower engine, and maybe they put in something a little more powerful. You get to number five is the quick repair aluminum alloy transverse engine. So it doesn't really tell you what kind of engine it has. Just tells you it has an aluminum engine. So engines have been made out of aluminum for a long time. Mass produced, you know, in the 60s. There were several manufacturers that made aluminum, you know, liquid cooled engines. It's, you know, lightweight. You can get a lot of power out of it. And it makes sense. So doesn't really give me any details of that, but if you take your engine out of the awe striker like you're supposed to, you'll find that it resembles more of a V-style engine, like a automotive V6 or V8. It's kind of a weird V8. It has the exhaust coming out of one section of the back. No exhaust manifolds on either side. You have the air inlet on the top, which looks like a little bit of a fan. Imagination can run wild. Is this a turbine engine? There's little details everywhere, and there's even a little bit of a transmission bell housing in the back. It plugs right into the rear differential on the awe striker. So, you know, you got a transaxle, you got a weird looking engine. Heck, I don't know about being a diesel, but you know, it's a neat little engine, and you know, I'm happy for it. I just wish I had a little more info on the blueprints. So this is one of those times where I like to nitpick, and I can't nitpick because it's a little too vague. So I can nitpick the vagueness, I guess. You get to the automatic cannon compensation weight. So this is number 6, and this is on the back of the cannon now. So we moved up all the way to the top of the awe striker. And basically, it's just what keeps the cannon level. You know, just it's a counterweight. Now we go back to number 7, the individual low back competition seats. Yeah, basically where the where crankcase and his passenger sits. You know, they're molded nice. It looks almost like they're stitched. It looks like they're essentially what would be like a Kirky aluminum racing seat. You know, the thin padding that would go over the aluminum frame. It's molded well as part of the rest of the mold of the interior of the awe striker. And we'll move down to number 8, the twin lateral battle platforms. Basically where you pick up your hitchhikers. So that's a little like mesh grate. Then we move back to the cannon, and the cannon's actually called a 10-round, 70-millimeter automatic launcher. So like I said, I think this is more of a like the tow missile attachment of the M1041. I don't know if it needs to be a 10-round, 70-millimeter cannon, but it is. And overall, the rest of the detail on this, besides the counterweight, it looks like you have a little sighting device on the top that must be connected somehow to the camera below. You've got nice detail. You've got a nice like flash suppressor tip on it. Really looks the part of what it needs to do. It looks, again, it's a little sci-fi because of the description. It's not 100% accurate to what was on the fast attack vehicle, but it is faithful enough to reality that the suspension of disbelief, you're not stretching for this. Now we'll move down to number 10, which is the advanced infrared sighting fire control camera. Now this has a hose that runs from this to the roll cage. This would be on the passenger side of the awe striker. And that's the right side because we know Britain and Australia, they drive on the right side. So this is an American vehicle. So everybody's driving on the left side. You know, it's good detail. It doesn't have a handle, so you kind of have to move it with your hands. Your passenger isn't going to be handling it. Another thing is, you know, these also commonly have stress marks as well. And the other thing is the hose sometimes doesn't really work too well. That's because one thing that I'm not a huge fan of is the hose on the camera exits the left and then it has to loop all the way around back to the right to then plug into the left on the roll cage. So if they had just moved that one plug from the left to the right, maybe they're thinking the hose would not get in the way better this way. I don't know, 6 of 1, half a dozen of another at this point. Also, this is another area where they added an extra detail that really lends itself to grounding the awe striker in reality. We get to number 11, the fiberglass body over tubular space frame. Sounds familiar, huh, to the fast attack vehicle. And again, it looks like it. You have the quartz halogen headlamps. And then you get to the secondary cannon sighting override camera. So that is the camera that's on top of the automatic launcher that I was pointing out earlier. So that's good that it has a secondary system. Don't know how it connects to the driver or the passenger, but it's there. You have a Canon guidance information processor. That's on the side of the Canon. You have the Canon control guidance link, which again is that hose that runs from the camera to the Canon. Number 16, of all things, the engine exhaust outlets, which are those two little pipes that come out of one side of the engine. And then you have the fully adjustable nitrogen dampened independent suspension. So like most dune buggies that were Volkswagen derived, this would have four-wheel independent suspension. They're pointing out at this point, they're looking at the front. Now, as a toy, this does have suspension. It's actually pretty neat. It doesn't have a lot of motion to it, and it does sag over time. Also is affected by weight. So the more figures you put on this, the more likely it's going to bottom out. I think a pen spring in the back to aid the leaf springs really helps the rear. I don't find the front usually getting too much weight on it. It's there because there's a lot going on in the front with a little bit of a suspension and steering. You know, the plastic obviously has aged, so you're not going to see so much of that suspension anymore. But it is nice because if you have a little bit, if this wasn't played with rough, the wheels don't drag on the fenders. I've had a lot of Austrikers, and a lot of times the rear tires especially drag on their rear fenders. When I assembled my Night Force Austriker, it didn't drag because it was fresh plastic. Then on the flip side, in the 50th anniversary line, they released the FOE, the Faux Striker. And I will say that I regret getting rid of mine when I was going through my moderns because I'm trying to, you know, stay to a theme here in the basement. And what I found with that, so that one had more of a machine gun vibe rather than a cannon vibe. So that was more of a M1040. You know, that had so many accessories, it actually weighted down and the suspension was dragging. And that was new. That was only 8 years ago when I looked at that. Number 18 is the vehicle identification number, which is basically the sticker, HER72653I. Okay, so we have an identification number. Not something I would normally point out on a blueprint, like the G.I. Joe logo, you know, the stickers, you know, United States, the star. Okay, that was a little bit too much. You get number 19, the 175/70 VR15 off-road tires. And I'm going to include this with number 20, the stamp steel 6.5 by 15 inch wheel rims. 175/70, that's a narrow but tall off-road tire that, you know, fits those 15-inch wheels. And the weird thing is those sizes exist in real life. And the final part, 21, is the front brush bar, which is molded in that green. So really the blueprints talked basically about everything in the car other than a few other details I want to mention. In the back, you do have a battery for the engine that's molded into the chassis. And then the rest of the cockpit, you have a cut steering wheel. So it's not a circular steering wheel. It's almost like the Knight Rider steering wheel. You know, you have a molded dash with some gauges in there that, you know, don't have really anything molded into it. So it's a little more simpler. And you have diamond plate for the footwells. You have a shifter in the middle. And then it looks like you got a little bit of a third link suspension going on in between the driver and passenger. You know, the detail is there to make it feel like a real vehicle. And that's one thing I've always enjoyed with G.I. Joe and G.I. Joe toys in general, is you're not just sticking the character in just to a generic spot. Their other toy lines would not have taken the time to put this kind of detail into, you know, their toys. But this thing is just loaded with detail. And again, probably helped that it was based on a real military vehicle. at the end of the day, you know, let's talk about staffing it. Let's talk about play pattern. This thing has, you know, besides crankcase driving it, this is one of those vehicles that basically any Joe can hop in and drive. You would assume that any G.I. Joe at least has a driver's license. So while they may not be a specialist driver, at least they can hop in and drive around. I mean, certainly everybody did in the Sunbow cartoon. With crankcase driving, who would I have in the passenger seat? Well, I would consider that person the gunner. So I would want somebody with gunning experience. So, you know, you could throw a Rampart, you can throw Pathfinder, you can throw Roadblock or Rock and Roll in there. So the possibilities are almost endless for the passenger seat there. Or what you can do in the passenger seat is you can put make this like a command car, and you can put an officer next to crankcase. So we're talking like Hawk, Falcon, Flint, you know, he's a warrant officer, Colonel Courage. It's something that, you know, again, you can put Doc riding shotgun. It's just an infantry vehicle. And, you know, G.I. Joe, all the Army guys and some of the Marines, you know, they're infantry, so they fit. The other thing, too, about your passenger is that could also be the radio guy. That could be insertion team. You could be sneak peek, you know, dropping them off to spy on the enemy. So there's a lot of recon. You got the cannon. You got the tow cannon. I would call this the tow, the wire-guided missile. So this can be an offensive weapon, taking out tanks. Probably would be something that would move along the desert quietly or quieter than other attack vehicles and initiate surprise attacks. And then two is just a getaway vehicle. And anybody that has seen Megaforce has seen, again, another variant of this. So a lot going on. This has a lot of use, a lot of potential. And the fact that the engine comes out, you know, that's good for when you have your 83 headquarters. You could have clutch servicing this with crankcase. You could have, you know, this fits well in a play pattern. It fits well in a diorama. It is really a vehicle that screams G.I. Joe. And the one thing I like about this, that's one of my big criteria for G.I. Joe vehicles in general, is the character actually fits inside the cockpit. This isn't like a Vamp. It's not like other vehicles with roll cage. The Battle Force 2001, his name escapes me at the moment. So crankcase fits in. Everybody fits in this. So with that, how would I rate this on a scale of 1 to 5 70 millimeter automatic launchers? Well, it's kind of iconic. A lot of use in the cartoon and comic. It's based on a real vehicle. It's faithful to the real vehicle. It's well made. Comes with a great figure. Even if you don't get the figure, this is a 570 millimeter automatic launcher. It belongs in just about every G.I. Joe collection. I can't think of a G.I. Joe collection that wouldn't have an Awestriker in it. It's small enough to be displayed with your figures if you're a figure guy. And if you're a vehicle guy, you got to have this. It has such a cornerstone part of the G.I. Joe lexicon, much like the Vamp or the Cobra Claw or the Cobra Ferret. It is just an absolute must-have. And let's say you're a fan of the Awestriker and you want to army build the Awestriker. You know, you don't always have to have the same Awestriker. It was released multiple times after 1985. You got the Eco Striker from 1992. And then in 1995, it was part of the Stargate line. And at this point, they modified the roll cage mold where they moved the gun from over the passenger's side to more central in the rear. And then it was released in 2001 in the Night Force colors. And then again, 2003, 2008, two variations, 2010, the Ninja Commando 2012, yet another Eco Striker in 2014, and then finally the FOE Striker in 2015. And then you have the Walmart Retro, which they actually fixed the roll cage mold and moved it back over to the right side. So this is an epic vehicle. It is, you know, you can get your share of them. You don't have to have just the one 1985. You can have it. You can have a bunch of 1985s. I like them. But you can get one of every kind, and you can just have a whole fleet of different Awestrikers. It just adds to the coolness of this, because it's like, well, okay, we have the Awestriker, but all right, Eco Force needs one. The Night Force needs one. You know, everybody gets an Awestriker, and everybody should get an Awestriker. That's how good this is. Well, if you've made it this far, thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this, feel free to rate and review wherever you listened, as it only helps to grow and improve this podcast. The Chaplain's Assistance MotorPod is hosted by Spotify for Podcasters. For more MotorPod, you can follow me on social media at Chaplain Joe Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Facebook, and even YouTube. Set those notifications on. Maybe you'll get notified the next time I do a live stream. You can also send an email to chaplainjoepod@gmail.com. The Chaplain's Assistance MotorPod is the strange, but not as strange, nerdy little brother of the pint, a pop culture podcast. You can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Now, with all that said and done, one final message for the masses: be decent to each other.